This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Earnings season officially underway with America's biggest banks among those to report third quarter results this week.
We're also going to talk about one of the leaders of those banks, the first woman to lead a top U.S. lender, Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser, the subject of our cover story. And it's a very special double issue this week. It's known as the Bloomberg Business Week persuasion issue.
And we'll explain more in just a moment. Also ahead on our broadcast, we'll talk Afghanistan and risk mitigation with retired four-star General Stanley McChrystal. And pick up on our conversation with tech titan Michael Dell. That is part of our Bloomberg Business Week talk series.
All that and more to come, but we begin by welcoming in the features editor at Bloomberg Business Week, Max Chafkin. Max, we're calling this the persuasion issue. Tell us why.
Yeah, well, so we got this idea about almost a year ago, if you can believe it. We're watching the vaccines get closer to release. The COVID vaccines, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, at some point, yes, everyone is worried about supply, but at some point, you know, convincing people, vaccine-resistant people, to get vaccinated is going to be a huge issue. And that kind of got us as a newsroom or as a magazine into conversations about just the importance of persuasion in business. You know, so much of business runs on convincing people to do things, to change their minds, to, you know, marketing, of course, is a kind of persuasion. Sales is persuasion. And then, you know, this vaccine issue, we were prescient on that. I mean, of course, now there's plenty of vaccine in the U.S. To go around, but there's this persistent group of people who are vaccine hesitant. So we were hoping to speak to more or less all these ideas with these stories.
Well, one of the features this week comes from Kurt Wagner, and we've come to know social media as a space that almost seems designed to rile people up and keep them coming back. Kurt writes that Twitter is actually trying to change that. How exactly?
Yeah, this story started a conversation with me and Kurt talking about whether Twitter could get people to stop dunking on one another. A dunk is when you retweet, you take someone else's tweet and put a witty or clever remark on top of it. But often they just become vectors for harassment, for, you know, crude language, for nastiness. And the thing about Twitter is, It's kind of made that part of the appeal. You know, this is the social network, until they banned him, that gave us Donald Trump. So much of Twitter is about these very heated conversations. And as Kurt writes, the company was kind of designed that way. It was designed to get people to kind of behave in outlandish or provocative ways in order to get followers. So the fact that they're trying to address that is significant. It's significant both, you know, as a business story, as a company story. If Twitter, the company, is able to do this, it could have implications for its long-term viability, but also could potentially hurt its growth. But it also has implications for all sorts of other social media companies, because as Kurt says in this excellent article, the idea of designing ways to stop people from being outrageous on social media kind of goes against everything social media design has stood for over the last 15 years. So in some ways it's kind of silly, but it's sort of a very bold and interesting move.
Yeah. Okay, so just real quick, Max, take us through some of those changes that Twitter has implemented, because people who don't use the platform might not have realized it over the past year.
Yeah, so they've added all of these what they call speed bumps. So if you're going to send a message, if you're going to take an article that you read on Twitter and broadcast it to your followers, it's going to put a pop-up in front of you and says, hey, do you want to read this first before you endorse it? So that's one of them. If you type in something, a curse or a racial slur or some other handful of offensive terms into a reply tweet, you know, when you're replying to somebody, it will put a pop-up in front of you and say, hey, you know, are you sure you want to do that? And not all of these have worked. Not all of these things have worked perfectly. It's not like right. Twitter is still in many ways, you know, full of nastiness. But there are encouraging signs here. And Kurt talked to these outside researchers who have been working with Twitter for years. And there's been a lot of frustration kind of from that community, the world of sort of academia and people who are interested in kind of dialing down the temperature on social media. They've been really frustrated with Twitter over the years, but they're starting to warm up to this company and starting to see some encouraging signs.
Another really provocative story, I think, that's part of this coverage, it talks about a spate of nonprofits who are trying to reform political extremists. In the same way, right, Max, that AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, works and helps people combat addiction. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yeah, so it's boom times for deprogramming. Deprogramming, I think, is not the politically correct term. I think de-radicalization is the term that these consultants and nonprofits prefer. But it's this idea that people who fall into extreme belief systems, can be talked out of it, and treating these extreme belief systems, and they really run the gamut, from radical Islamism to kind of far right, white nationalist type extremism, and as you say, they're treating it like an addiction, and like it's something that these people are compelled to do.
Right.
And one of the most interesting things in this article to me, the main character, and I mean it's a really breathtaking story, and I don't want to ruin the whole thing, but the main character, who's a young man who has fallen in with various extreme ideologies, he bounces between ideologies. It's not like he embraces radical Islam, but then he falls into sort of far right, white nationalist type behavior, and then he gets into snakes, and so it's just this thing where I think the internet in particular has exploited vulnerabilities that some percentage of the population have, where they're just drawn to these ideologies,
right?
And the internet kind of turbocharges it.
All right, that's Max Chafkin, features editor at Bloomberg Business Week. Our special double issue, The Persuasion Issue, it's out on newsstands and online now.
Coming up, retired 4-star General Stan McChrystal on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and dealing with risks in all walks of life.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, safe to say he knows a lot about the subject of risk, dealing with it, facing it, managing it, and Tim now writing about it.
Retired 4-star General Stan McChrystal is former commander of the Joint Special Operations in Iraq and founder of the McChrystal Group. His latest book, Risk, A User's Guide, aims to help individuals and organizations mitigate risk.
Yeah, he's lived a life filled with the deadly risks of combat. We know that. We began, though, our conversation along those lines by asking for his thoughts on the recent U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan, where he also served.
I was sad to see the way it played out overall, because many of us became very emotionally connected with Afghanistan, so it's important to remember that, because I also would tell you that's one of the reasons my views are biased by my personal opinion. I think that it's unfortunate we pulled out, but I would say that I think President Biden made a courageous decision. I mean, the accord that was signed in Doha by President Trump's administration essentially set a hard date of 1 May 2021. So President Biden was faced with the choice of either abrogating that agreement and extending the war, or following it, which is essentially what he did. People have asked me if I agreed with it, and my answer is I respect the decision by the commander-in-chief. It's not the recommendation I would have made, but that's the way our system's supposed to work. Military leaders provide best advice, and then the president decides.
The top U.S. military officer, we're talking about General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he called the 20-year war in Afghanistan a strategic failure. Why was that? And do you agree?
Well, I couldn't argue with the fact that it was a failure. If I tried to say, no, it's a success, I think that'd be disingenuous. Mm. However, I will say that it wasn't completely for naught. Afghanistan's a very different country than it was in 2001 when we went back. So the reality is the 20 years of educational opportunities for females, for young people, and other advances, the Taliban are going to try to control a very different state. And I'm hopeful in the long term that either causes them to change the way they lead or opens opportunities for different governance.
I'm wondering, General McChrystal, if the way that the United States left Afghanistan, if it tarnishes the United States' reputation in the view of countries around the world.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't help. there were some miscalculations that came out, and I don't find fault with the planning, but, you know, things happen. But the reality is, when people see it from afar, whether they are our potential enemies, in which case they might think less of us, or our potential allies, and they are trying to decide if we are a reliable, capable partner. So in a very public world, as I'll describe it, every time you have a challenge like that, it has some effect on your reputation. So like a commercial firm, we now need to work on that. We need to pay attention and work to try to recover a bit of lost ground there.
Well, you know, the world continues to find itself in some incredibly risky situations. Your book is all about it. And I think about whether it was the financial crisis, the pandemic that we're still dealing with, today's increasingly crisis within the energy sector, cyber attacks. Are leaders ignoring the signs, or are their systems for detecting risk not good currently, focusing on the wrong signs and methodologies, or risk in terms of obviously like pulling out of something like Afghanistan?
Yeah, I would say first, we don't assess risk very well because we're always externally trying to predict what they will be and when they'll come. And that's really just too hard because they're too varied. I think we need to be looking internal more.
What is it that you think a leader needs to keep in mind when it comes to diversity and assessing risk?
I think we think about diversity too often as just gender or race or religious background. We're really talking about difference of perspectives. And so if we talk about bringing together a team, we'll call it a board of directors or anything else. If you have diversity on a superficial level of gender and whatnot, you might not have diversity of perspective. You might have people all from the same background, all bankers, all whatever. And so what they'll do is they'll leave blind spots. And diversity needs to be thought of not as equality. Equality is a legal right and a moral right. Diversity is an operational necessity for organizations. So it's ensuring that you've got people that are looking from every different angle and bring different experience and expertise.
Have a question for you. And, you know, I'm going to give credit where credit's due because your team kind of shared some thoughts with us. But one of the things that came to their mind, and we think this is just spot on, is how do you feel U.S. leadership dealt with COVID-19 and what could have been done differently?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think they fumbled it pretty badly. If you think about COVID-19, although it is a dangerous risk, it's not 10 feet tall, it's not unbeatable, and it wasn't unexpected. We have this kind of challenge every few years, and we know a lot about public health, so we actually know what to do about it. And then, of course, we got the help with the scientific miracle of a fast vaccine. But if you think about from the beginning, what we really needed was clear communication, even admitting what we don't know, informing the national population. And then we needed a clear narrative. How is our nation going to deal with that? Tell people, if we want to use a war analogy, as I think would have been appropriate, we ask every American to take part in the common defense of every other American. And then, of course, we go down the willingness to make decisions, overcome the inertia that sometimes causes us issues, and the ability to be adaptable as things change, like the rise of the Delta variant. In almost every case, we fumbled it pretty badly. And I would argue that the 700,000 Americans that we have lost is far more than we ever needed to lose.
Do you think, General McChrystal, that Americans would have made that sacrifice if it was communicated that to them in the way that you communicated it to us? Because it does seem like right now there is not a sense of shared sacrifice among all of us right now with the way that people act when it comes to being asked to wear a mask, taking a vaccine mandate, that sort of thing.
Jim, you're right. I think that they would have. Of course, we couldn't approve it until we did it. But if we go back in times in our history, when we have asked the American people to sacrifice and be a part of that, we've had very good results. And I think that's the only way to go when we're trying to do something that affects all of us.
That was retired four-star General Stan McChrystal, founder of the McChrystal Group. His latest book, Risk, A User's Guide, is out now.
And the McChrystal Group, by the way, helped the city of Boston during the pandemic. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, the latest installment of our Bloomberg Business Week Talk series, and it's with Dell Technologies founder, chairman, and CEO Michael Dell. We'll get into that. We've also got our cover story this week. It is on Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser, who is looking to change your mind about how we work and about Citi's comeback.
And up next, we catch up with the president of the software maker Splunk, Teresa Carlson. She spent about a decade as a senior executive at Amazon Web Services before joining Splunk earlier this year. And look, she definitely knows a thing or two about the cloud. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
It's a company with a market cap in excess of $25 billion. And late last month, you might remember, Piper Sandler came out saying it was a top pick heading into the fourth quarter.
We're talking about the infrastructure software and data platform company Splunk, where Teresa Carlson serves as president and chief growth officer.
Her background's pretty impressive. She previously led Amazon Web Services' public sector business for more than a decade. And in just 6 months at her new company, she says her work with clients to access, use, and secure data, more important than ever.
There's no literally customer that I talked to before I came here that didn't tell me that their use of Splunk, they said, is mission critical for their business. And I think it's demonstrated through the types of customers we work with, which are really the Fortune 100, 90 plus of the Fortune 100 customers work with us. But it's going really well. We are moving to the cloud very quickly, and that's one of the reasons I came over here, to continue to help our customers move to the cloud and take full advantage of Splunk Cloud.
How much was that move to the cloud accelerated during the pandemic? And again, I know you've only been there for 6 months, but I know that you know about what's been happening there over the last 18 months during the pandemic. I know that you have 93 of the Fortune 100 companies using the product. How much was that accelerated during the pandemic, and how much more room is there to grow?
Well, we grew our annual cloud revenue by over 70% for the 10th straight quarter. And so it just continues to show you the acceleration of the cloud. And I will kind of share some of my previous experience at AWS that demonstrated this, because I ran our public sector business and industries groups at AWS. And during COVID, we saw acceleration within our customers, like 2 years to 3 years of acceleration to the cloud during the pandemic, because they could not get into their data centers. They could not get in and take advantage of their applications. So many of them had to port or rebuild those applications very quickly. So especially if you're talking in mission critical areas like government, healthcare, financial services, telco, areas that really the world cannot do without, they have to keep going. So they had to figure out how they got use of their technology when many of their employees could not go into the data centers. So you saw the growth of cloud computing really moving fast. And I heard so many customers say it was such a differentiator for them in their business and their mission during that time. And it also accelerated the use of cloud skills. And of course, one of the primary things that Splunk is, as a data company, the customers need to be able to take advantage and use their data. So as a result of that, customers really started saying to themselves, how do I make that move more rapidly?
You guys think too, and you have such a great perspective, Teresa, because you were leading the Amazon Web Services public sector business for more than a decade. And then you, of course, are now at Splunk. But I am curious about data democratization. Is that truly achievable? And won't there always be some entities or parties or countries, China, for example, that will have access to more and better data? And so there will always be some kind of imbalance and power plays or powerful components when it comes to the data universe?
Well, I don't know about better data, but, efficiency of the use of that data. And there's still no companies that drives innovation more rapidly than U.S. companies. I mean, if you look at the use and the growth of cloud tools, AWS that, kind of started from scratch, they are web services from day one when nobody really even knew what cloud was. And then you have Google, you have Microsoft, and you have this explosion of startups as a result of cloud computing. And the companies in the U.S. and around the world that are developing as a result of cloud computing, the access and lead that they have with data is quite amazing. But I would say what's the most important is the ability to take advantage and use your data. And one of the big key trends that's happening is, open source data that's out there can be utilized in massive ways to actually understand a problem set. And you saw this as an example happening during COVID, where you saw crowdsourcing going on so people could solve the problems faster of what was going on and have deeper understanding.
Right.
But in terms of the data elements itself, I would just say, if you look at all the companies like Palantir, Confluent, and others that have gone public, you are seeing companies that are truly data-driven, and they have slices of the way they use their data and tag it that allows these companies to really do things that they never thought of doing.
Right.
Now they can throw their data in somewhere and it gets organized. They don't have to put it in all these tables.
That's Teresa Carlson, President and Chief Growth Officer at the publicly traded software maker and data company, Splunk.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, we pick up on our conversation from last week with the founder, chairman, and CEO of Dell Technologies, none other than Michael Dell, including his thoughts on the next big technological breakthrough and facing down Carl Icahn.
Got to say, in the book, he talks about having dinner at Carl Icahn's house, and Mrs. Icahn cooked for them. It's a great read. And that's another edition of Bloomberg Business Week Talks. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
So last week we featured a little bit of our conversation with Michael Dell. It was when he talked about the near-term outlook for Dell Technologies and really the broader technology sector. There's so much going on, certainly in the financial markets when it comes to tech stocks, and really just broader in terms of some macro themes. Well, in part two of our conversation, we're going to dive deeper into the billionaire innovator's origins.
We also got his thoughts on the labor crunch taking place across the U.S. and also what he thinks is the next big technological breakthrough. Here's a hint. AI is going to play a big role.
That's a pretty big hint, Tim.
Yeah, it is.
Just going to say. A portion of this interview is featured in this week's Double Issue. It's part of our Bloomberg Business Week Talk series. And we start off with a story from Dell's new book. It's entitled Play Nice But Win, A CEO's Journey from Founder to Leader. And it's about facing down activist investor Carl Icahn when he bought a stake in the company in Dell and tried to block Michael Dell's move to take the company private.
It was very hard. You know, I didn't really have much experience dealing with somebody who would just go on television and lie. You know, that's not something I had experienced very often in my business career. But, you know, ultimately, as I talked about in the book, I did go to his house and confront him and, you know, really saw that he didn't have any plan whatsoever for the company. And to him, it was just a big poker game. You know, it turned out to be way more difficult than I thought, as was chronicled on Bloomberg television and radio very extensively.
I remember it.
It was a story that never ended until it did. And fortunately, we were able to accelerate our transformation. Our shareholders got some of the benefits of our transformation if we were successful, which we turned out we were, without taking on any of the risk. And I learned how to face down Carl Icahn. So there you go.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm wondering, Michael, if you miss the days of running a company that's private, that doesn't have a report card available to you each and every day, Monday through Friday, from 9:30 to 4 every day, where you watch the company's stock move, because you do talk a little bit in the book about the way that big swings in the company's stock would make you feel, and the way that you thought that analysts and investors were missing it. Do you miss the days of not running a public company?
Well, I've done both, right? And the key for us was really putting the company on a different trajectory. And back in 2012 and 2013, the markets really didn't give us permission to go invest in those new areas. Now I think we're in a different spot, new capabilities, new growth rate, and new trajectory. And, you know, we also reignited that entrepreneurial spirit, which was the formation of the company, and very much kept that alive even as we've transitioned back to being public again.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, and we've really leaned on, I think even more so during the pandemic, our leaders, right, of companies to help us get it through. I think about Black Lives Matter. And, you know, one of the things we wanted to ask you, and it feels like from reading your book, you don't play around too much or careful around politics, and I can understand that for CEOs. But you know, your home state of Texas, you know, I have a lot of family in Texas. You seem to be, you know, you really love that state, and you write a lot about it in your book. How do you feel about things like the abortion law and the voting rights one? Would you have spoken out about?
Yeah, I have spoken out about voting rights, and certainly we've communicated with our team members about you know, some of the recent laws. Look, I would much rather see our policymakers focus on education and infrastructure and broadband and, you know, the things that will help the state continue to be successful. And as we've communicated to our team members, you know, our belief is that you know, they should have more access to healthcare, not less.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry though about, you know, some of these issues that it'll hurt Dell's ability to attract talent, especially in Austin, or generally speaking?
Haven't seen that problem yet. We'll see how it plays out. And you know, our company will go where the talent is, and you know, let's see also how the courts, you know, rule on these things. And you know, I think there's still a lot that we don't know about how this plays out.
Hey, Michael, I want to stick on talent, because we have spoken to executives in recent months who've said, hey, the labor crunch that we're seeing, it's really across the spectrum from hourly employees all the way up to executives. Have you had to raise wages to attract and retain talent?
Well, you're always adjusting, you know, compensation and benefits. I'm pretty pleased with our attrition. You know, our data says, you know, we're in the, you know, kind of lower quartile of attrition. So haven't really had an enormous challenge there, as I know many companies have. And look, you know, our job is to create an inspiring and you know, passionate environment where people can do their very best work. And we attract a lot of young people into our company, give them those opportunities. I think if we keep doing that, you know, we'll be just fine.
EMC, it is a company that we know. We've all talked about it. You know, the king of growing storage device market. We know cloud computing is changing all of this. You know, we were talking with some of our colleagues, a former EMC executive telling them that EMC was once the last great storage companies. There'll never be another one. So what is the future of that market in your view? And how do you think Dell specifically can benefit from that?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you peel back the onion on just about anything that's going on, you were talking about crypto earlier, mm-hmm. decentralized finance, autonomous vehicles, you know, just pick your new thing that's happening. Behind all of that is an enormous amount of data. And, you know, it turns out you need a lot of cloud infrastructure, no matter where it is, and you need a lot of data to make all these things happen. And so, you know, as the number one company in the world that provides all of that, we're seeing some really nice growth in those areas. So I think the world's kind of figuring out, yeah, public cloud is a thing, but it's not just the public cloud, it's multi-cloud, it's also the edge, and there's enormous growth going on as everything in the world becomes intelligent and connected. And now with 5G, the distributed computing world is even more distributed. All that creates enormous opportunities for us.
Have to say that, you know, we want to talk a little bit about innovation. We've got a few minutes left. Mike Bloomberg stopped by my desk. I was working. I have a huge pile of books. And he's like, do you read all of these? And I'm like, I try. I said, but one book I'm reading right now is Michael Dell's new book. And he's like, I know Michael. And he goes, really smart guy, really innovative guy. And it was just kind of interesting. And he talked about, you know, how you reinvented your company. When it comes to innovation, reinvention, what are the technologies that you think we should be focusing on? You know, what gets you excited? Is it crypto? Is it AI? Is it something? Is it the metaverse? What do you think is interesting? Because reading your book, I mean, you've been involved in the tech space since you were a kid. And I just wonder what really catches your attention now.
Yeah, you know, the power of AI to, again, use all this data to upend and reinvent every part of our world and society is incredible. I think there are going to be incredible innovations in the intersection of the biological and computational sciences in all the areas you talked about.
Yeah,
it's hard to predict exactly how all these things are going to evolve, but when you have these powerful ingredient technologies coming together. And look, you have an enormous amount of risk capital right now that's going after these problems and even harder hard tech problems. I think that the future is super bright for humankind.
That's Dell Technologies founder, chairman, and CEO Michael Dell on the next big tech breakthrough. Check out his new book, Play Nice But Win, A CEO's Journey from Founder to Leader. I got to say, Tim, it's a fun read.
It's a really fun read. We get a lot of books.
Yes. Okay?
We get a lot of books. And look, I got to be honest. I don't read them all.
I don't have enough time in the day, unfortunately.
This was a fun one, though.
It was. It was just his stories and from kid to, tech entrepreneur to a very wealthy and successful individual, one of the wealthiest in the country.
Well, you can hear the entire interview at Bloomberg.com, and a portion of it is featured in our latest edition of Business Week Talks in this week's Double Issue.
That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Coming up in our next hour, we're talking to shopping and traveling. If you're planning on doing either of those things in the next few months, and probably a lot of you are, you're going to want to stick around.
Gotta say, I'm just getting back to traveling for the first time, getting on a plane, looking forward to it. We've got some important insight on the retail sector from the president of the International Council of Shopping Centers and our Pursuits team. It's out with its annual ski issue.
We're talking Vail, we're talking Big Sky and more. This one speaks to me.
I know it did. I bet you were taking notes or like taking the whole section home.
Plus, we'll catch up with award-winning actor and best-selling author, also entrepreneur, Sam Heughan.
Yeah, he does it all. I've been looking forward to this. And yes, we are talking about the Hunkin Outlander. There, I said it.
You did. Went there.
All the women out there are thinking the same thing. And I'm going to say some guys, too, might be interested in hearing from him. I want to be inclusive. That's what we are at Bloomberg Business Week. Straight ahead, our cover story, too, on Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser, the first woman to run a top U.S. bank who is trying to lead a long-shot comeback and torment her rivals in the process. You know what's interesting? Sam Heughan, the actor, he plays Jamie Fraser on the Outlander series. And then we've got Jane Fraser, who is the cover story of Business Week. Yeah, it all just comes together, doesn't it?
Synergies, they call that, right?
Synergies. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovic.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a visit from a man who literally does it all. Award-winning actor, best-selling author, whiskey maker, and philanthropist, Sam Heughan pays us a visit.
Plus, tis the season for holiday shopping and skiing, too. How supply chain constraints could actually affect retailers in the coming months, and where to go when you're ready to hit the slopes. I'm already ready.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So ready. First up this hour, though, let's get to the cover story of this week's Double Issue. The first woman to lead a top U.S. bank has a plan to remake one of America's biggest lenders.
Bloomberg News finance reporter Jenny Serain wrote the piece about Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser, who's not afraid to give her workers what they want as long as it means crushing the competition.
They're just an interesting company. You know, they've had a really rough go of it recently, and I think they needed this fresh air and fresh blood, and they've got that. And so it'll be interesting to kind of see where she takes it from here.
Well, speaking of fresh air, I mean, the piece literally opens with fresh air, talking about an outdoor space that Citi has for employees, and also the way that Citi is different than the other majors in thinking about a return to work. Take us through what Jane Fraser is doing and why this is kind of crazy for what's happening on Wall Street.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So a lot of where this started was just we were hearing grumblings over and over again that people were leaving other banks and joining Citi simply because they really liked the way she talked about the future of work and what that looks like. And so, you know, she's doing the thing where they are allowed to work from home at least 2 days a week on a permanent basis. That's one thing. But I think the more interesting thing that she said is it's not just about this hybrid half in, half out situation. They're also being really flexible. So, you know, if it's 3 o'clock and you want to knock off and go pick up your kids from school or take them to a soccer soccer game, that's fine. You know, log on later and finish your work up whenever you can. It's this whole idea of flexibility that people seem to really appreciate. You know, she's acknowledging that people are not just robots at a desk, that they're real people with real lives, and really embracing that.
All right, so don't penalize me, because I really hate this. Is like, is it because she's a woman that she looks at it differently? Because that kind of makes me crazy. But there is that. But is it also a leader who's understanding that the world has changed because of the pandemic, and we have shown, certainly the big banks, how much they could get done home? Is it also, third, kind of her sticking to the other banks and saying, you know, it's a fight for competition. And so if this is what we have to do to kind of draw in talent, this makes sense.
Yeah, I think she's definitely unique in that she seems more willing to listen to her employees and has kind of let that guide a lot of her decisions, you know, since becoming CEO. And also she was president before that. So I think she's very unique. A lot of the other CEOs kind of get an idea in their head and stick to it and don't really let a lot of advice come their way. But I think she's very unique in that sense. And I do think, you know, it's a war for talent right now. These banks are, it's a very cutthroat environment for bankers, for traders, for engineers, for all sorts of different folks. And she's acknowledging that, and I think really kind of setting them apart.
I thought of the other cover story that was on Business Week. I don't know, was it over the summer, where it's like, basically, I don't get out of bed for $120,000 just to steal, you know, the supermodel line. But it was basically because we just continue to see, right, Tim, that Wall Street, the big banks, the big firms are upping kind of salaries for some of their, you know, starting junior bankers, whatever, you know, we just see that happening.
Well, when, Jenny, will we start to see this pay off? If there is this talent war, and we know this talent war is happening, when will we start to see the moves that Jane Fraser is making in terms of poaching talent and perhaps just as important, retaining talent?
Yeah, so that's the big big question, I think, facing all of the efforts that they're making. They've already started to have some successes. There's been some big names that have left Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Google, and joined Jane in her big journey. And I think it's not just talent. You know, it's also this whole energy that she's trying to bring to the turnaround there, and really just trying to set them apart and set them on this path towards excellence is the word that they like to use, which is all, you know, to be fair, they are.
She did work for McKinsey.
She did work for McKinsey. She's
sorry, McKinsey, love you, McKinsey, now. But you know, right?
She's definitely. I mean, she has that consultant brain, and the yeah. You can kind of see a lot of that McKinsey touch in the strategy refresh that she's kind of venturing out on. So she's, you know, focused on wealth. She talks a lot about prioritizing high return businesses, deprioritizing the low return businesses. That's McKinsey.
Well, let's talk about it. I remember very early on in my career when Sandy Weill was at Citi, right? And he bought Smith Barney. He was making this financial supermarket company. And I remember under the red umbrella and like doing the whole thing, doing a stand-up. But what's interesting is wealth management, right? They lost Smith Barney eventually or sold it off. Is that an area they've got to be a bigger player in?
So Jane certainly thinks so. And I think, you know, if you look at some of the big success stories on Wall Street of the last decade, it was wealth management shops. Morgan Stanley bought Smith Barney and has since turned mm-hmm. it into this powerhouse. And so I think, you know, it's definitely a high returning business. Citi has long, you know, punched under their weight there. And so it's kind of an easy one where they already have a little bit of scale. They just got to invest and get it a little bit bigger.
But internally, or do they have to acquire, or can they acquire? Is there anything out there?
They're a little bit hamstrung right now. They've, you know, last year they had the OCC and the Fed ding them for some longstanding issues with their internal controls. And so they're really limited in the amount of M&A activity that they can do because of that. Everything has to be run by their regulators. So I think they're, you know, really focused on an organic growth strategy with this. And yeah, wealth management, everybody's making lots of money there.
That was Bloomberg News finance reporter Jenny Serain on her Business Week cover story on Citi's woman in charge, Jane Fraser.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, a little bit of everything, some skiing, some shopping, and a very handsome and talented actor and author. Outlander star Sam Heughan stops by. He's a philanthropist, too, and he is really encouraging other people to challenge themselves. And as he does it, he's raising a lot of money for charity.
You've spoken to him a few times, Carol.
Actually, this will be my second time. I've watched him a lot
okay.
in the streaming series, but have been watching his progression, especially in social media, because he really is reaching out in a lot of different ways to the world at large.
A really incredible career. It's a great interview.
Yeah, it was definitely a fun conversation. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Follow him on social media and you'll see the many facets of our next guest, actor Yes For Certain, in the wildly popular streaming series Outlander. Many people are watching, Tim.
He's also an author set to release a follow-up to the New York Times bestseller Clanlands, Whiskey Warfare and a Scottish Adventure like no other.
His new book is entitled The Clanlands Almanac. He also has new TV and film projects on the horizon. He's got his own line of whiskey. I've sampled it. It's pretty darn good. even his own charity. Sam Heughan joined us in studio to talk about how he's managing all of that in the midst of a pandemic and coming out of a pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously impacted everyone, but business-wise, more than anything, it's delayed a lot of imports and exports, especially with our whiskey.
Did it complicate things?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think you've maybe seen the pictures of, you know, the container ships outside Long Beach. I think there's about 40 of them out there at the moment. Things are just really slow, you know, globally. It's been tough. You know, we've been challenged with the cork for our stoppers in our bottles, you know, trying to get access to that.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Or just even getting a container to transport our whiskey across from the UK. So, yeah, it's been challenging.
What changes did you have to make as a result of these challenges? Did you have to raise prices? Did you have to change materials?
Or just be patient?
I think that's pretty much it. You know, people were waiting for our next release. We released last year, and then this is our biggest release. We wanted it to be out in time for obviously the holiday season, but it's finally here. We were actually only delayed a couple of weeks, so we're pretty fortunate.
How much fun are you having with this? And tell us about like taking it around and introducing it to people.
Yeah, so I'm really proud. Obviously, self-financed, self-realized, you know, I designed everything, you know, every aspect of the brand.
Self-finance, so you bootstrapped it all.
Yeah. So we haven't any investors. We've done it all ourselves. And as I said, it's our second round. We've won about 7 double gold medals from various awards. I'm just really proud of it. It's my baby.
Can you talk about why you bootstrapped it and chose not to bring on outside investors? Did you not want to dilute the equity?
I think so. You know, I mean, firstly, it is a small limited batch release. You know, it's hard to get our hands on enough of the product. Yeah. So we didn't need finance at the first. But then also, you know, just to retain the rights, to retain the majority share or control of it. And as I said, it is a passion project. So I really didn't want to give anything away. There may be a time when we do look at finance.
Are people knocking on the door?
We've definitely had conversations and you know, there will be a point where we want to really upscale and increase. And I think at that point, investment would really help us.
Because it's interesting in the marketplace, you know, it's a crowded marketplace, but when you can create a brand that somehow has some interesting distinction to it, and I think this one is safe to say it does also taste good, you can really move ahead. What's been the response that you're hearing? And as you, because you're meeting with people in New York and elsewhere.
Yeah, well, so we're now available in, I think about 40 states. We're working on the rest of them, and we're working on Canada as well and Europe. It's a whiskey that I wanted people to be accessible. You know, a lot of people haven't tried whiskey or don't know much about Scotch whiskey. This is a blend. There wasn't really a premium blend out there that I felt was comparable to like the Asian blends out there, which are really phenomenal. So we wanted to create something like that, modern, but also, you know, with a nod to our heritage. So we've got some great malt whiskey in here.
We did want to talk to you a little bit about what's it like on the set? Because it looks like you guys have just an incredible group of people.
It is, yeah. We've been obviously on the show now almost, I think, about 8 years. We're in our sixth season is about to come out. And it really, it's we're this sort of real core ensemble of actors. And it's been good. I mean, this was the hardest year, definitely, you know, with obviously COVID situation, but also we were shooting in winter.
Right.
It was tough. I mean, it was really difficult, but a really strong season. And I think that's what brings you, or gets you through something like that. You know, your sort of friendship and your bonds and with the crew as well. You know, it's like one big family.
What are the COVID protocols and how is it different this season than it was in previous seasons before we were talking about COVID each and every day?
Yeah, you know, so I worked on a movie as well during COVID, a movie called Text for You. Also, Men in Kilts shows. We were one of the first shows to shoot in the UK with the COVID protocols. For Outlander, it was different and difficult because it's such a big show. You know, we have so many extras. We're out out in Scotland, so it did delay us by a number of months. But the protocols, you know, everyone was tested every day. We actually had a testing center in the production offices, which was amazing. They could do a rapid test. So you get tested every morning. We had bubbles.
You did have bubbles, right? Yeah. This is what we heard from when we were talking as stuff came back.
So basically different, depending on sort of your level or what your function is in on set, you would then be in, allocated a certain bubble, yeah.
When you drink whiskey on the set, are you drinking real whiskey?
Absolutely, of course, all the time. Yeah.
I don't believe you. Wait a minute. Yeah. You and I were talking, we were talking around the table here about your brand, the Sassenach. So is there more to come? Are you going to expand this?
Yeah, you put me on the spot. Yeah, well, you know, obviously.
You could say no.
Absolutely. You know, our tagline is unique spirits. So we are looking, you know, around the world for, you know, unique opportunities and really just shining the spotlight on, you know, great producers and collaborating with other people. So, but, you know, obviously the whiskey is our main priority. It's our first spirit, and we really want to establish that and let that grow as well.
One last one on the spirit. What else gets your attention?
We're a little obsessed
in the spirits industry right now.
I mean, there's just, you know, I mean, the explosion of tequila obviously is really interesting. I've spent a lot of time over in Tequila Town, which is a really fun place. But you know, you even look in the UK, I mean, gin is really big. It's kind of almost overpopulated now. But yeah, I'm really interested in just like these small producers. I mean, mezcal is just fascinating, you know, and it's hard for them to upscale. So I'd love to go to Oaxaca and spend a bit of time there.
How long do you think you might hold on to the brand before maybe something, you know, we talk about people being interested, and we know certainly some of the bigger brands are always looking for new players, new entries. Mm. Do you think that the end game is that ultimately it becomes part of somebody's portfolio?
To be honest, I don't know. It's obviously very close to my heart. I poured so much of myself into this, so I want to retain it. Okay. But who knows in the future where that could go.
That's award-winning actor, New York Times bestselling author, entrepreneur, and philanthropist Sam Heughan. He does it all.
He does do it all, and it's really pretty impressive. And I always think about when someone is an actor or, you know, in the entertainment business and they start to branch out, how do they make decisions, right, about kind of where they put their efforts? Because I'm guessing people are probably calling all the time.
Yeah, time is a finite resource.
Yeah, I'm learning that all the time still. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, ready or not, the holiday shopping season, it's upon us, and supply chain concerns are only adding to stress levels.
We'll hear from the president of the International Council of Shopping Centers, Tom McGee. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
President Joe Biden wants to break a logjam at U.S. ports and stave off a holiday season of shortages and delays. In remarks this past week, the president announcing the Port of Los Angeles would begin operating 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. My only question, and Tim, your only question was like, why weren't we doing this weeks ago? Because we've been talking about supply chain problems for months.
Yeah, and they're able to actually work so much more efficiently in those off hours. So why now? Anyway, he did call the move a, quote, big first step as U.S. imports reach record highs. The good news, Carol, though, is that retailers say they're stocked, at least for now. Mm. We talked about the sales outlook in the critical months ahead with the president of the International Council of Shopping Centers, Tom McGee.
We're forecasting nearly 9% year-over-year growth in holiday sales from 2020. You know, I think all the conditions that have led to strong retail sales during the course of this year, whether it's a lot of fiscal stimulus, high personal savings rates, you know, a strong job market, will all be the same factors that contribute to strong holiday sales. I think the consumer is back. They're willing to spend. But supply chain issues, you know, could be the X factor that could impact that.
It's interesting you say that about consumer back, because we've talked about some sentiment indicators being down. When you say 9% growth in holiday sales year over year, is that because there's going to be higher prices? Like, what are we talking about? What does that metric really measure?
Well, certainly there's been inflation from 1 year to the next, but it's really driven more based upon, you know, volume growth. You know, and that was based upon a fairly strong, you know, 2020 holiday season. Although 2020 retail sales were down, over the course of most of the year. Last year, holiday sales actually increased year over year as a lot of people leaned into holiday spending. You know, overall for 2021, we're forecasting 11.5% retail sales growth. Again, a lot of 2020 was way down. So, you know, I think it's broad based. You know, we're expecting about 5% growth in physical stores,
okay,
about 13% growth in e-commerce, and a lot of growth in things like food and beverage as well, as people continue to eat out.
I'm really glad you brought that up, Tom, because, you know, if we were having this conversation 2 years ago in 2019, I think we'd be talking a lot about experiences. Last year, the conversation was all about actual physical things because people, you know, there was no vaccine. We were still kind of stuck inside to a certain extent. What is the mix this year with people buying people gift certificates to restaurants, gift certificates to experiences versus buying physical things, especially if you can't get your hands on some of those physical things?
Well, I think the predominance is people will be focused upon buying physical things. Outside of the traditional going out to eat and entertainment that, you know, upticks in the holiday season, and we think this will uptick significantly this year. But I do think there'll be an increase in gift certificates. Look, I think that there is, if we have the supply chain challenges that we think we may experience, I think you will see people continue to buy and spend, but they might buy and spend on gift certificates to allow that person that they're buying the gift for to be able to choose what they want in 2022. So you may see a lingering impact of kind of the positive spending in the holiday of 2021 positively impact retailers in the early part of 2022 as people redeem those gift certificates.
Tom, one of the things I've also wondered about, I know we talked a little bit about supply chains, but I have been curious about the real estate market when it comes to shopping centers. And I know it's been a story that's been around for a while. What are you seeing on that front when it comes to vacancies and stores?
Well, you know, I think there's an increasing level of optimism. Obviously, the industry was at the epicenter of, you know, the pandemic and you know, was significantly impacted by, you know, all the health and safety measures that took place. But the level of optimism in the industry, and honestly, the level of leasing activity is really at its highest level in my, you know, in my tenure as the head of ICSC. We had a group of industry leaders together in Boston just a few weeks ago, and there was a great deal of optimism amongst the group. A lot of new store openings. Actually, store openings exceed store closings this year by 3-1 year to date. Obviously, 2020 was a different story, but you're starting to see a real releasing of a lot of that space take place. And, you know, we just did a study with Placer AI that looks at analytics of consumer behavior. And really, foot traffic is, generally speaking, both in the open air segment and also in the mall segment, back to pre-pandemic levels.
Really?
Close to 2019 levels.
Wow.
And so you're starting to see a real emergence. That's not to say that there aren't challenged properties.
Yeah.
The U.S. is a big country, the challenges in the mall sector in particular, which gets a lot of attention.
That's Tom McGee, president of the International Council of Shopping Centers.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, who's ready to hit the slopes? Tim Stenovec.
I'm always ready. I mean, I'm the type of, I would go to the Southern Hemisphere in the summer in order to get some skiing.
I could see that. We go from holiday shopping to planning your next big winter trip, and it's going to involve skiing.
A look at our annual ski section and some industry insights from the incoming CEO at Vail Resorts. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
It's that time. Tim, we're approaching the holiday season. Many of us starting to actually think about taking the next big trip.
I'm certainly always thinking about it. And you know, Carol, we often dispatch our Bloomberg team to seek out the most beautiful beaches and remote island paradises. For some reason, though, we're not part of
that
team,
happen?
I guess.
They get all the good gigs.
Well, this week, they're hitting the slopes everywhere, from Aspen to the Alps.
They do indeed. Our Bloomberg Pursuits editor, Chris Rouser, joining us now with a look at our annual ski issue. And Chris, let's start with the cover of Pursuits this week. It's in Big Sky, Montana. Sounds like some big changes happening there.
First of all, you guys, two things. One, you can join our team anytime.
Aww.
Please, I will make my life.
Done. We're in.
And, And two, if you guys are just planning your holiday travel now, it's probably too late.
Oh, say it ain't so.
Bummer. We're done with Chris.
If you want to go skiing sometime in January, February, or March, we have everything that you need to know about for the section in our section this week. And yeah, our opening package is about Big Sky in Montana, which is not a place I've ever gone skiing because it has always been sort of seemed so like rugged and off-piste. And I like a little bit of fanciness when I ski. But now they've added a bunch of new lifts. Like really modern lifts, like the fastest six-person chair in North America, and they're adding two big, new, fancy, posh, very comfortable hotels. So it's part of a whole $150 million, 10-year renovation project, and now we're beginning to really see the fruits of that transition in Big Sky.
It's amazing. I mean, Big Sky is a special place in my heart. It's probably where I took the best ski trip of my life, and it was sometime in the last 15 years. And you're right, it is rugged. You know, we did some off-piste skiing that required avalanche beacons and probes and, you know, signing in with ski patrol at the top of the big couloir. It really felt rugged. I mean, it really felt like you were in the American West. Does it lose any of that if it becomes more like Vail, if it becomes more like Aspen?
So that's, you know, that's the big challenge for Boyne Resorts, who are the people that own Big Sky. And their effort is to try to make it like an American version of the Alps. So like if you go skiing in the Alps in France and Italy and Switzerland, you have no lack of difficult terrain, off-piste stuff that's, you know, going to be the best day of your life, but also make you hate your life. But also, you know, there's wonderful on slope experiences where you can stop in and get a glass of wine and, some beef bourguignon and, you know, go to a great opera-ski place with a beautiful view. And so that's what they're trying to get at. They're trying to get at, okay, you can still do the really crazy terrain. You can still take the tram up to Lone Peak, or go off piste. But at the end of the day, you can have a little bit more comfort, you know, because 20 years ago, Big Sky didn't even have a grocery store to like stock up your condo. It really has come a long way.
Yeah, it sounds like, Chris, I mean, based on the story, it's not about only, you know, improving the ski accommodations and everything that's there, but it's like building really a community around it, right?
Yeah. So in 1990, only 500 people lived in the unincorporated region of Big Sky.
Wow.
And now it's more than 3,000. Skier growth has, you know, it's grown 46% in skier visits in the past 5 years. So just a lot more people are going, and not only the hotels, but a lot more residential is being built. So condos, and that could be everything from a big fancy condo to something more, you know, more normal, you know, multiple families in a building. They're trying to get, you know, just kind of all different kinds of people to come.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about hotels and lodging outside of Big Sky, because part of the Pursuit section this week includes an update to hotels and ski areas around the world, including Switzerland, Japan, Canada, France, and in the U.S., including Aspen and Vail. Pick out a couple of your favorites from this, Chris.
Yeah. So, you know, the big dream ski place for me and for a lot of people is Niseko in Japan. And because the powder is supposed to be more magical there than anywhere else.
They call it Japao.
Japao, exactly.
Yeah,
Japao.
Really,
and, you know, they just in the past few years have started getting really luxurious hotels, which, of course, at Pursuit, as you know, what we love. And there is a new Ritz-Carlton Reserve there, which is, I think, going to be really exciting for a lot of our readers. Also, there's a new Club Med in Quebec. And we have lately in Pursuit been very pro Club Med because a lot of us have had children recently.
Right. See how your perspective changes?
So we've gone from being like, oh, that's an all-inclusive resort. That sounds kind of tacky, to like, oh, my God, they'll take your child for a day. Okay, perfect. So we're excited about that one in Quebec. And then in Aspen, you know, there's not really a lot of turnover really in Aspen usually with the hotels, but over the past few years, there have been with a new W. There's a Viewline Resort in Snowmass, which is a Marriott autograph collection. And then there's a hotel in Vail called The Hythe, which is right by the Eagle Bond Gondola. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, fun new things to try in the U.S. too.
Well, you mentioned Vail, and I feel like when it comes to ski resorts, we can't, we've got to talk about what's going there. And they're one of the, you know, publicly held ski resorts. So let's talk about Vail, because they've got a new operator taking over. And I love this story. It's entitled The City Kid Takes Over at Vail. So tell us about Kirsten Lynch.
Yeah, so Kirsten Lynch on November 1st is going to become the CEO of Vail, which really, for the past few years, has been steering the conversation in American skiing, and has really, by acquiring other resorts, has really actually sort of dominated American skiing. And she's been working at Vail for a long time, and she was in marketing, and actually she created their app, the Epic Mix app. Which is helps you track your runs, can show you where, you know, what trails are groomed, what trails are crowded. It's like a real live ski map for you, which is actually useful. You don't have to like pull out the condition, the paper grooming report, or, you know, at the end of the day try to remember how many runs you did. So she's had all these sort of clever innovations while she was working in marketing at Vail, and now she's taking over, and she's actually the first woman CEO of any of these ski resorts, and actually among the few in any kind of hospitality organization in America.
So just to date myself a little bit, I lived in Vail for a few years after college, more than 3 years, and we didn't have the Epic Mix app back then. We had iPhones. I didn't have an iPhone. It was when they first came out.
Were you a BlackBerry person?
I did have a BlackBerry at the time.
Who didn't?
But one thing we did when I lived in Vail, and I would do with my friends, Chris, is after working all day, we would grab our skis, our Telemark gear, and we'd actually ski uphill. And it's increasingly become something that a lot more people are doing these days. And in fact, we were doing it for free. It was just allowed. But resorts all over the country are starting to charge for uphilling.
Yeah, so uphilling is the semi-masochistic art of strapping on your skis, putting some skins.
No, Chris, you got to earn your turns.
Yeah. With the skins are things that you put on your skis that help you walk uphill in your skis, and you get these special detachable bindings. And basically, you walk to the top of the mountain, and you ski down, which means that at the beginning of the pandemic, when lifts were closed, you could go up onto the mountains and ski on your own, basically have the mountain to yourself, or you can go before the lifts open, which of course serious skiers like you really want to do. And because it actually has become such a thing over the past 2 years and really, really grown, some of the resorts have started charging a small amount for tickets. You know, it could be $20 for a day. It could be $90 for a whole season. And basically what the goal with the charging is to get you to sign a liability waiver because they want you to, they need you to like sign away that you won't sue them if something happens. And they just want to regulate it a little bit more, but it's become really a big thing. And I grew up in New England. I wasn't fancy like you, Tim. I didn't go live in Vail for 3 years, but
oh, we weren't doing it in a fancy way. Trust
Tim,
me.
Come on, you were jumping from helicopters. We
no,
know
I wasn't. I wasn't.
You're among friends. You can share.
I was what they refer to, you know, locally as a dirtbag.
What I want to know is why would you go uphill?
Well, we did it because, well, for a few reasons. One, you can do it to access terrain that you can't access on a lift.
Okay.
But the reason we did it is because we would be working all day, and we could go uphill when the lifts were closed. So we'd go uphill for an hour, couple hours, and then go have a beer and a burger.
Sounds like it was a great workout.
It was. It is a great workout. You're doing it at 8,000 feet, too.
Yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah. Earning your turns, it means something, right? Hey, listen, also in the magazine, you guys talk about the gear that you need to do this. It sounds like there's a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So, you know, you need skins for the bottom of your skis. You need special bindings. There are boots that are designed for it by Dynafit, which actually Formula One engineers helped design. I didn't really know, actually, because I'm not super familiar with the snowboard version of this, but split boards, you can get a snowboard that actually splits into two. So you can walk up the hill on two skis and then it clips back together and then you carve down which blew my mind, but obviously people have known about this for a long time.
Chris, thank you so much. Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser with a look at our annual ski special. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into our Bloomberg Business Week daily show Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
Also, check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Business Week now available on newsstands, at Bloomberg.com, at BusinessWeek.com, and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend.
Stay safe, everyone. This is Bloomberg.